KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Two consecutive terms with over 50% of the vote. That's something we haven't seen since Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Other finalists included Apple CEO Tim Cook and Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi. South Koreans have elected their next president. Jason Strother reports from Seoul that the new leader is South Korea's first female president.
Surrounded by her supporters in sub-freezing temperature, Park Geun-hye delivered her acceptance speech. She defeated the progressive candidate Moon Jae-in, a former human rights lawyer. Park, the 60-year-old daughter of the country's late dictator Park Chung-hee, will be sworn into office in February. Park, who once compared herself to Britain's Margaret Thatcher, has recently softened her image. She promised to enhance social welfare programs while on the campaign trail. Park says she also wants better relations with North Korea. For NPR News, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul.
Israel is moving ahead with construction of new homes in East Jerusalem. The decision is sparking international criticism. Opponents say the latest development is problematic because it will impede access to East Jerusalem from the West Bank. Israel's development plans come after the UN voted in favor of a Palestinian state. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Pajamagram Company, offering hoodie footy PJs, footed pajamas with a hood, at pajamagram.com.
These women, missing and murdered women, were forsaken twice, once by society at large and again by the police.
Every 4 to 6 years throughout the history of America since the Republic began, we've had economic slowdowns.
Most enduring traditions of the season are best enjoyed in the warm embrace of kith and kin. This tree is a symbol of the spirit of the Griswold family Christmas.
I was Griswold talking like that in that movie. I don't remember. We'll find out when we talk about Christmas movies. Maybe we'll find out. Maybe we'll have to rent the Griswold family Christmas movie with Chevy Chase. We're going to talk about films with Robert Horton. We're going to talk about the economy, upturns and downturns when John Talton gets here. But we start with Vaughn Palmer, political correspondent with the Vancouver Sun and a regular guest on Weekday. You heard that clip taking a look into an inquiry commission that reported on how mass murderer Robert Picton was able to prey with impunity on women on Vancouver's downtown east side. Hello, Vaughn.
Hello, Steve.
This slams the police in the Picton case.
Yeah, it's not exactly holiday season reading, I can tell you that. The thing runs about 1,500 pages, five volumes. The executive summary alone is 170 pages, so...
Whoa!
It's pretty grim reading. Picton is the worst mass murderer in Canadian history. He preyed on very vulnerable women in and around Vancouver for decades, and finally caught and sent to prison and convicted. But this inquiry, headed by a former Attorney General of British Columbia, Wally Opal, and a former judge of our appeal court. It's a very damning report on police and also on society's neglect of these women. About a third of them were Native Indians. The other two-thirds were people who'd, you know, been abandoned by other communities.
He was quoted in the paper is saying the missing women were simply treated as nobodies. What kind of response do the police have after something like that?
Well, Vancouver's police chief, Jim Chu, apologized. The RCMP have acknowledged failings as well. I guess the two things that you'd pick out of this report that are most disturbing, one is that there certainly were reports and concerns for a long time in that region of Vancouver that women were disappearing and not accounted for. So there was a concern there and had been for a long time. This is a story that came to the forefront partly as a result of some very good news media coverage. The Vancouver Sun, the paper that I work for, put together a lot of the pattern, really, and got things moving. So that's important. But the fact that they just didn't deal with it. There wasn't a concern that the women were treated. There was even a case where, in 1997, where a woman was taken home by this guy and stabbed in the stomach. She managed to escape, and she told the police all about it, and the charge of assault was laid, and then they decided she wasn't a very reliable witness, so they never proceeded. And another 5 years passed, and another 20 women disappeared, so they actually had a chance to catch him. The other thing, apart from the neglect, the commissioner says is very, very important, is to recognize we have essentially a fragmented jurisdiction in and around Vancouver. You have the Royal Canadian Mounted Police as the police force for some local governments. You have local police forces for others. That, particularly at that time, they weren't coordinated. They didn't work well together. They passed the buck. They treated fiefdoms a mess, really. And OPAL recommended a regional police force. I don't think it's going to happen, but that's what he's recommended.
That's very interesting. That's very interesting that he would recommend that.
OPAL did a report for the British Columbia government on policing back in the 1990s. He recommended the same thing. And, you know, this sort of thing, I mean, it's really interesting when you stand and just look at it on the sidelines, right? Like the police forces, they don't want to give up their jurisdiction. They protect their turf. Local mayors and councillors, they don't want to lose their local police force because, you know, I mean, they can phone up the chief and say, well, why don't you deal with this? Why don't you deal with that? They're worried that if you had a regional police force, they'd lose control of their police. Maybe some of their problems wouldn't be dealt with, and some other municipality, some other local government's problems would be dealt with. It's all this turf war and fiefdoms. It's depressing to look at it. But in order to bring about regional force, and there's been a call for a long time for a regional police force in and around BC capital, Victoria as well, in order to do that, essentially a senior government would have to come in, break down the barriers, impose it, and also take all the political heat from local governments and local people who keep electing councils that want to protect their local police force.
Well, Vaughn, let's stick with how people have to deal with politics here. What was the reaction in Canada to the Newtown shootings?
Oh, an outpouring of moral superiority. I hate to say that, but I sent you one of the more moderate editorials and commentaries that's come out here. It's in our national newspaper, the Globe and Mail, and there's probably no subject on which Canadians would sooner preach to Americans about than guns. And, you know, I guess what I would say on this is, yes, there are other countries around the world that deal with the thing differently. Americans are well aware of that. I mean, there was certainly an outpouring of grief here. I don't think anybody wasn't shocked. Anyone wasn't moved by the way the president himself almost lost it when he was talking about it. I mean, I don't even know how he got through the speech, so there's all that. I guess I'd say two things about the situation here. It is not unheard of for us in Canada to have this kind of rampage. In fact, the Connecticut shooting occurred just a few days after Canadians were marking again the sad anniversary of a guy who shot up a bunch of women in an engineering class, killed a whole bunch of women in an engineering class in university in Montreal more than a decade ago. So we have had it here. The Canadian government has regulated, as have the Australians, some of the weapons. It is the only way you can get the gun that was used in Connecticut is if you belong to a gun club in Canada. Canadian government has regulated how many rounds of ammunition you can have. They've regulated the use of pistols. So we do have tougher gun laws. It doesn't mean that we don't have pretty disturbing gun incidents. But I think a lot of Canadians and Canadian commentators have pointed to the situation here. What the Australians did after that terrible mass shooting in Hobart in Tasmania, which is they regulated access to weapons.
Well, the editorial you sent argued that the Kimver Gill shooting in Dawson College in Montreal,
yes,
there were many fewer deaths because though this guy was shooting people up, he didn't have that kind of assault weapon.
Yeah, he did not. Now, there are still some, I don't know guns in detail, but there have been stories in Canadian media in the last couple of days saying that some of the guns used in this country in mass shootings, not as easy to fire off multiple shots as the AR, the Bushmaster AR-15, but for example, the Kim Vergil weapon, which was a Beretta, he got off 72 rounds and he injured 16 people and killed one. That weapon is still available in Canada. So some guns are available here. And Canadians have a lot of guns. They tend to be, Canadians who live in rural parts of the country, and Canadians who hunt or, as I say, live in rural parts of the country, there aren't as many guns. Last time I saw the stats, there aren't as many guns in Canadian cities as there are in American cities. Canadians don't, I would say, feel as threatened in the way that Americans do in that respect.
But you have some of the similar carry laws, and people can have handguns, concealed weapons in Canada?
You can get a very good debate going over whether or not it's our laws or our political culture or the fact that we don't have a right to bear arms in the Constitution, or a combination of all three. I mean, you know, we have access to the same video games. We go see the same movies. We share the language, read the same books. We worry about our kids playing too many violent video games and watching TV. We do have the occasional shooting. They are tragic. Fortunately, we don't have as many as occur in the United States.
All right, Vaughn, and last, real quick here, the Bank of Canada says Mark Carney, who's the next Bank of England governor, did not breach some rules. He had a holiday stay with the opposition leader. You are under scrutiny if you're going to be running the Bank of England,
well,
huh?
Well, the amazing thing is that Carney sort of, you know, when we talked about it, he's the first non-Englishman, he's a Canadian, to head the Bank of the Bank of England. And Canadians very, very proud when he was elevated there a few weeks ago. But since then, there's this little flap has erupted over the fact that this he was being recruited for another job over the summer. And there'd been a kind of a rumbling about this, but not a lot of details. And the job he was being recruited for was to be Prime Minister of Canada, to run for the leadership of the Liberal Party of Canada, which is vacant at the moment, and that Carney would be this sort of superstar leader and of the Liberals, and then would be their leader in the next election in a couple of years. Turns out that Carney spent a vacation, just a vacation, they say, not a recruitment event, with a leader of the Liberal Party, not the party leader, but a prominent Liberal, at his holiday home. They're old friends. And this has kind of been used to highlight, well, you know, bankers are supposed to stay the hell out of politics, especially the head of the Bank of Canada, which is supposed to be a nonpartisan job. And if he's kind of being sounded out to lead a political party and hanging out with a prominent member of that party, does he have a conflict? Well, you're right. The bank has ruled that he didn't have a conflict. He's still the head of the Bank of Canada till next summer. And so the bank has ruled he didn't have a conflict. But it's a little bit of a political taint to a golden boy of banking. And the British have picked up on this story as well and reported on it. So Carney will be under pretty close scrutiny to make sure that he doesn't show partisan tendencies over there.
All right, Vaughn. Merry Christmas. We'll talk to you after the holiday. We'll talk about the whole year.
That's great. Boxing Day, too.
Oh, yeah. Very excited.
We're going to do the next show on Boxing Day.
Very excited. I'll have some things I want to take back.
Okay.
Vaughn Palmer, thanks a lot. Vaughn Palmer is political correspondent with the Vancouver Sun. He joins us every Wednesday on Weekday.
Good morning. It's 10:19. You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. What's your favorite Christmas movie? Film critic Robert Horton joins us with his list of holiday favorites. That's coming up next.
Support for KUOW comes from University Volkswagen Audi, committed to providing customer care through the exclusive Passport Service Program, which includes service loaner vehicles, rideshare shuttle service, and a knowledgeable staff. More information online at uvwaudi.com.
Clouds and rain, 40 degrees right now in the U District. Forecast calls for clouds and rain the rest of today, the high in the mid-40s, cloudy, rainy, and windy tonight and tomorrow. Tonight's low 39, tomorrow's high reaching 42.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat.
The sparkling drinks are just dandy.
We're going out to the lobby and looking at the Christmas tree this time of year with Robert Horton, who writes for the Herald and Everett, reviews films for us, talks about the cultural moment, is the author of Rotten, talks to the Humanities Washington audiences about the future of the future of the past. How's that? That's nice.
I have no idea what that means.
Future of the past. You talk about science fiction and how science fiction films affected their culture.
I have talked about that, and I also talk about the Western these days.
Ah.
Yeah.
Well, that's the past of the future.
You are blowing my mind here, yes.
Or saying gibberish. But today, yes, holiday movies, and then you added some, you were thinking about some winter films.
Thought we'd broaden it out a little bit, bring in some snow. Yeah.
Can we first talk about, like, my favorite Hollywood films?
Oh, we should.
My favorite holiday films?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, It's a Wonderful Life.
Yes.
White Christmas.
Yes.
I don't know what else. You tell me some more.
Well, we should note that It's a Wonderful Life is playing at the Grand Illusion, as it does every year, in 35 millimeter. I think they've been doing that for over 30 years.
It even played there when it was Potterville.
Ooh. Yeah. The Potterville Twin Cinema. So, yes, that's an absolutely great film. Well, do you like... I like White Christmas as well, of course.
Yes.
That is a movie with a lot of memorable songs. Sisters, for instance.
Sisters.
Enjoy that when Bing Crosby and Danny Kaye do it in drag.
Yes.
Interesting thing to see when you're a kid.
Challenge your assumptions.
Well, yeah, yeah.
Breaking the rules.
Maybe a little more transgressive than is given credit for.
Yeah. And I like the Danny Kaye, and I think he's good in this.
He is good in that. And
I know we've had discussions about Danny Kaye in the past.
Well, maybe we have, but Crosby is also good in that.
Yes, but...
Crosby is very relaxed in that movie.
He's very relaxed.
He's like, I don't really need to, I just need to be my Bingle self.
Yeah.
I can just walk through this. Has anybody got a drink?
Yeah.
And I'll go do this scene.
He was wonderful.
Yeah.
Dean Jagger.
The old man, as they call him, yeah.
Who was probably younger than both of those guys.
That's often the way those things work. Rosemary Clooney, very good and a rare film appearance.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an excellent film.
And Vera Ellen, skinny.
Very skinny.
Very thin.
Very thin woman.
Yeah.
And as we have said before, not Holiday Hotel, which
Holiday Inn, yeah.
Holiday Inn, which you find to be got some problems with the business.
I'm afraid we're going to have to bring this up again because if you have a hotel that's only open on holidays, I don't see the business model. I don't see it working out.
It's just not working.
No.
And as White Christmas has superseded a Holiday Inn, I think perhaps you are proven right.
I don't know. I don't know. Maybe Fred Astaire and Bing Crosby still have that place out there somewhere.
There's been some nice, obscure, holiday films that I've enjoyed. Christmas in Connecticut?
Yeah. It's a good one.
Yeah. Is Barbara Stanwyck in that?
She is in that one.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
There are some wonderful, odd movies that...
Miracle on 34th Street.
Well,
that's not odd.
That's a well-known one, of course. Yeah. But that one, you could say it's better than... just taking as an old chestnut that we've all seen. I mean, it's a really good movie.
Yeah, it is.
It really is a well-made film.
I believe my current hero, John Payne, is the star of that. The male star.
Yeah.
The male star.
Yeah.
Second lead.
Yeah. Well, nobody beats Santa Claus. But,
no.
Yes, John Payne, very likable, interesting actor.
Yeah.
Not widely heralded, but quite good.
Yeah, did some interesting stuff. But what else? What other holiday films were you thinking of? Before we get to the snow films, the winter films. Do you have some other holiday films that you're thinking about?
Well,
that you enjoy?
You know, some of the offbeat ones would include The Ref.
The Ref?
A film with Judy Davis and Kevin Spacey as a couple.
Got kidnapped by...
Yeah, got kind of house-napped. The guy breaks
Dennis
into their
O'Leary.
House. Dennis Leary.
Dennis Leary. I mean, I'm just adding things to...
Just add an extra syllable to all these things. Very funny film. Has a real cult reputation. People are fond of that. And going along with that sort of downbeat thing, Bad Santa.
Bad Santa.
Billy Bob Thornton.
He's pretty good in that.
A really nasty film. Very, very profane. Offensive.
Yeah.
Offensive to almost everyone.
Yeah.
So you should know that before you go into it, but a hilarious film as well.
Now, do you like the Elf? Elf? Do you like Elf?
I have come to enjoy Elf, yeah. When I first saw Elf, I thought it got a little too syrupy, but it's actually, you know, it kind of plays off.
Syrupy. It plays it off.
It's kind of tongue-in-cheek and syrupy at the same time. And syrup is actually one of the favorite food groups of Will Ferrell. Yes. Candy corn, candy canes. It's quite a funny film. Yes, I have to admit.
I have a lot of respect for the film. Ed Asner's Santa Claus. And the cops in the Central Park.
I mean, it's got Bob Newhart in it.
Yeah.
It's got to get some props just for
modern
that.
Modern classic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Were there any great holiday films in the 50s or 60s? Like Christmas movies? I guess a Christmas movie, Christmas Tale. When was that one made? The one that Darren McGavin...
Well, that was going into the 80s.
That's the
it was like
80s
83,
by now.
Yeah. You know, in this weird way, one of my favorite 60s holiday things is... a few of them were for TV, like Charlie Brown Christmas, like How the Grinch Stole Christmas, the cartoon narrated by Boris Karloff, and an old favorite, Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol.
Yes. Oh, Magoo.
I mean, I don't know. I enjoyed it then. I still enjoy it now. I don't know what that says, but it's got some really good songs in it actually. And I don't know, I'm a little embarrassed about it, but
you track it down and watch it. Huh?
Yeah, it's good.
All right.
It actually is I think pretty good.
All right, Magoo.
Magoo as Ebenezer Scrooge.
Now I hope everybody.
How did they get that idea? I don't know whose idea that was. Hey, we got an opening here on Christmas Eve. Has anybody got anything? How about the guy who does the Magoo cartoons? Yeah. I know. And yet it works.
Think people know Magoo today?
No, I don't think so.
So this could be a revelation and a discovery for the younger crowd.
It could be. Could be.
Wow. You were saying you wanted to widen it out to just wintry movies.
Well, I was thinking of wintry movies, yeah. And speaking of Billy Bob Thornton, there is a film... I think it was 1998, called A Simple Plan, directed by future Spider-Man filmmaker Sam Raimi, which is a pretty good little suspense picture. And it's got one of those classic setups. Some people out in the middle of nowhere find just a big bunch of cash, and they make the wrong decision, which is to just keep it and, you know, not notify anybody. And what happens after that is what happens in movies whenever people do that, which is that people start turning on each other and suspecting each other. And I haven't seen it since it first came out, but I recall it as a nice, taut little number. And it's mostly set in the snow, as I recall. And it's got a very... Bill Paxton and Bridget Fonda are the...
Bridget Fonda's in it, that's right.
Yeah, a couple of the main stars. But Billy Bob Thornton's performance... he plays a character who's slightly mentally challenged, but not to a great deal, perhaps. But he's just an unusual, you know, person. But he really crafts a performance out of that is, I would say, you know, superior to the genre movie that's going on around him. Really quite memorable.
Well, all right. I do remember the scene where it's Bill Paxton is dragging something through the snow, but I can't remember what
it
is.
Yeah,
but that's good that I don't remember.
Well, you'll be able to discover
it
again. Yes.
All right. What else you got on that list?
Well, Snowy. I mean, I would toss out Fargo. It's a kind of one that never really gets old. You know, Eyes Wide Shut, a film, Stanley Kubrick's last film, is set just about at Christmas time, and it doesn't have anything to do with Christmas, except in interesting ways. A lighted Christmas tree often finds its way into the background of this shot or that shot. And it's very it's not explained why this would be happening, but it creates a kind of an interesting undercurrent to the whole thing. And it starts with the Christmas party Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman play a successful Manhattan couple, and they attend this party. And I just think it's a movie that was met with some disappointment when it first came out. Gee, it's Kubrick's last film, but I don't know, it's a little slow. And I think it's really taken on more respect and sort of taken its place.
You've watched it more and you've had new assessments.
Well, I loved it when it came out, but I think it holds up pretty well. And it's a really unusual film, very unnerving. And really? It has Tom Cruise in a role that is very good for him. It uses him in a way, which I assume he was complicit with, but I don't know. I'm not sure. But it kind of uses that giant grin of his and the complacency that he radiates through most of his performances in other movies. And it just punctures that. It just lets all the air out of that over the course of a few days that happen in the movie.
So Eyes Wide Shut, Jack Reacher. If you want to get a good sense of Tom Cruise's range, you could look at both of those.
I guess. I haven't seen Jack Reacher yet, so I'll find out in a few days.
All right. What else?
Do
you have Groundhog Day there?
Well, I wrote Groundhog Day down, yeah.
That's a different holiday.
It is a different holiday. And yet it takes place in a snowy clime.
Yeah.
And it's wintry. So you just have to adjust by not that much more than a month.
Yeah, I guess so.
Forward. I thought it was legit.
And it's a wonderful film.
And it is a good movie, awfully good. There's a film that I think probably few people have heard of, but I would like to recommend it, called The Fast Runner, which is made by a Canadian filmmaker who
first
is
Canadian.
A part of the Inuit population, and was shot on a relatively low budget and all that, but it's an epic film. It's long, and it covers this great story that feels kind of ancient. And it's spectacular, and it's one of those movies that is so you can tell that it's coming from inside a culture rather than somebody coming in, because the people on screen are not sentimentalized. You know, they don't have special wisdom because they're close to the earth, that any of that kind of stuff that people project onto some populations. It's just the people on screen are human beings, and they have problems, and sometimes utterly mundane ones that are almost funny, and they have passions. And they are close to the earth because they have to survive. It's just a life or death thing. It's not, you know, mystical or anything like that. And it plays out in these incredible places, you know, that are captured by low-budget cameras, but it looks really cool anyway. And I have to say, it almost has the reach of like a David Lean film, but on a micro level. You know, without the giant populations and the great production design and all that kind of thing.
I remember when The Fast Runner came out. I remember you liking it then. Remember that.
Did I rave about it then?
Yeah.
It was probably 10 years ago.
Yeah. You also have Never Cry Wolf down there.
Never Cry
That's
Wolf.
That's nice to think about again.
Another movie in a northern clime. Yeah. That about a guy who goes up to somewhere near Alaska. I don't remember if it's over the Alaska border or maybe it's just northern Canada, and is going to observe the wolves, and does so. And so much of the film plays out in without dialogue and silence, and a guy in the middle of nowhere just looking at animals. Charles Martin Smith.
Charles Martin Smith.
I almost said Charles Nelson Reilly, which would have been a very different kind of film, but fantastic.
Yeah, I'm liking that already. If you could meet the Grinch or Santa Claus up there, all the better.
Yes. Charles Martin Smith, wonderful kind of lunch bucket kind of actor, got the lead role in that. And
he was in American Graffiti.
Yeah, he was the toad in American Graffiti.
That's great. Yeah, that was a fun movie. That was a good movie.
Yeah, it is. It's
a cold movie. It's cold
very,
inducing.
You will be very cold, yeah. And it's a film that is... I had to watch it again for a project I was doing a couple years ago, and I thought it's a nice movie. It's by the director who went on to make The Black Stallion, which became a beloved children's film.
And it was a Disney film, too, if I'm not
produced
mistaken.
By Disney, yeah.
Yeah, good for them.
Yeah, right.
And you also have Dr. Zhivago on there, just because Julie Christie and Omar Sharif being cold and kissing.
Yeah, wearing, you know, gigantic furs, I guess.
Yeah, big, no, it's, big hats.
It's, yeah, it's one of those movies that you think about. I mean, it doesn't all take place in winter or snow or anything, but you think about, if you think about Dr. Zhivago, you probably get vistas of snow. And here's the real David Lean doing his thing and creating all those, you know, just incredible set pieces. And, you know, so it's funny because some people, some filmmakers have a talent for weather, like Kurosawa, for instance. David Lean was one of those people, I think, who had a talent for weather, which we don't often talk about in terms of appreciating movies, but it can be a really vital thing. And there's some snow and ice in Dr. Zhivago that is very compelling.
Because done right, it's just so evocative. Yeah,
yeah.
You feel it.
Yeah.
I see what you're saying.
There's that moment when Omar Sharif and Julie Christie go to the house that's kind of been frozen over. It's been abandoned, I guess, for a while. And everything in this house is just dripping with icicles, and it just has become this place that's embedded, you know, like almost a permanence. And, you know, once you see that, you never forget it.
Well, I don't remember that. I want to see that
again.
Well,
you've got to see it.
I've seen the movie.
Yeah.
It made me cry. I was very young.
Good old Dr. Zhivago. It is one of those movies that for me is, you know, it might fail certain tests of great cinema because I think it does, but it is
because
so...
Because why? Because it's hollow in some ways, or what do you mean?
Yeah, actually, I think that might be a good word for it. There's, as a movie, there's something missing at the center of it, I always thought, including something about the love story between those two people, and it's a little melodramatic / silly at times even, and yet it's just so big and so sweeping and so, you know, the kind of thing that they don't make anymore, which they don't, that it is, and David Lean, as a filmmaker, has such a strong feeling for what's going on that it'll work on you, and the music.
Yeah, know. Yeah, the music.
It's very hard to resist. Something on that big a scale.
So I was thinking about other holiday films again, because I saw a great holiday film, which I see as the number one holiday film on the Forbes list.
Oh, well, that's the authority.
Forbes is the authority. Yes. Die Hard.
Yes. So people forget that it's set on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day or whatever it was.
Christmas Eve, right? He's flying.
I assume so, yeah. Yeah, he's come to the building. Are they having a Christmas party? Is that how?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the Nakamura building.
It is a Christmas movie, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, you know, an actual Christmas film that I would also recommend is Fanny and Alexander, Ingmar Bergman's great magnum opus from the early 1980s. If you can watch, and you should watch, the 5-hour version of that he made for Swedish television, was released as 3 hours in theaters in America. It opens with a Christmas sequence that probably goes on for about 90 minutes, and it is the most opulent, lush, gorgeous evocation of a certain kind of bygone Christmas celebration that you will ever experience.
That sounds great.
It's an amazing... I think it's a great film, and that whole sequence is just absolutely remarkable.
Now you're stirring my memory. Did Lassie Hallström's My Life as a Dog have a Christmas scene in it?
I haven't seen that since it first came out, but it might.
I just seem to remember a Christmas tree and the little boy in the doghouse for some reason. Well, it was another film evoking of weather.
Yeah, well, that's a wonderful, My Life as a Dog is a wonderful movie anyway, so whether it relates to our discussion or not, by all means, see it.
All right, any films we should mention that we didn't mention? What about The Nightmare Before Christmas, Tim Burton's film? That was a Christmas film.
Yeah, kind of a Halloween movie, but there's some Christmas stuff in there too.
The Bishop's Wife, did you like that movie? Cary Grant, David Niven?
The old version, yeah.
Yeah, the old version. Oh, Denzel.
They remade it, yeah, a few years ago. Very lame remake.
But the old version was okay.
I would say solid Christmas perennial, yeah.
I say see Christmas in Connecticut, though, just because whoever sees that.
Yeah.
And that was a good old film from that era.
I concur.
All right. Any other films you would like to kick off on before we jingle bell our way out of here?
Oh, I know. I want to hear
Jingle All the Way. We could do that one. Right?
That was
a classic.
You can throw that in if you want for the hardcore Arnold Schwarzenegger fans out there. Yeah. I'm sorry we had to end on that note.
I am too. Well, I apologize.
That's okay.
All right. Merry Christmas.
Happy holidays to you.
and to you and to all of you. Robert Horton is a film critic, writes for the Herald and Everett, talks to us about films. This is Weekday.
We'll get the very latest on the negotiations between President Obama and House Speaker John Boehner over the so-called fiscal cliff. That's coming up next.
Support for KUOW comes from the Irritable Bowel Syndrome Treatment Center, specializing in IBS, food allergies and sensitivities, celiac disease, and related digestive problems. Details on customized treatment options at ibstreatmentcenter.com or on Facebook.
Used to be that a high school graduate in Michigan could get a job at a factory, make a decent wage, and retire with a pension. Used to be.
A lot of McDonald's jobs, low-paying jobs mainly. I don't know if there are that many middle-class jobs available out there, mainly the lower or the higher.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the missing middle class in Michigan, next time on Marketplace from APM.
That story and more coming up tonight at 6:30. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. It's 10:40. We have clouds and rain, 40 degrees in the U District. We're expecting clouds and rain the rest of today, the high in the mid-40s. Cloudy, rainy, and windy tonight, the low in the upper 30s.
Now some analysis and thoughts from John Talton, who writes in the Seattle Times. He also writes in his column. He also writes at his blog, theroguecolumnist.typepad.com right now because you have some technical issues.
I do.
And he's a novelist of 9, coming soon 10 novels of characters from around Cincinnati and Seattle and Phoenix. You have 3 series. 3.
I know. It's like having a disease.
All right. Let's start with the news. As you tweeted 29 minutes ago, Washington unemployment drops to 7.8%.
It does, and that takes us back to almost before the big jobs drop off during the Great Recession. The bad news is that we only created about 1,600 new jobs in November, and so what this means as a whole is that we're having this continued problem of people dropping out of the labor force. Good dropping out of the labor force is that older baby boomers who are relatively financially set are retiring early.
Lots of them.
Lots of them. Right? But then there's the bad news of labor force participation is that older people who will never get hired again because they are older people cannot get work. And the longer they're without work, the more their skills stagnate, the less somebody's likely to hire them. And then we have younger people who get out of college or don't go to college and they can't get work. There was just a story in the New York Times about the large number of young people who are actually living on the streets because they can't get work.
Yeah. Yeah. This is help me put this in some context, because as you know, of course, during the campaign, part of the argument was that we shouldn't look at the unemployment. We should look at real unemployment and not the numbers that come out and, that seem to indicate the economy improving when there's a structural problem that remains.
Well, there is this thing called the U6 index, which is as close as you get to real unemployment. And this shows the people who are quote-unquote officially unemployed, and then the people who are in part-time work, but they would really rather have full-time jobs, and then the people who are not actively looking, going in every week, registering. They want work, but they've given up looking. And when you look at the U6, you know, you're up in the 15% range, and Washington has one of the highest U6s in the country.
So tell me, is this a sick economy still, even though we see the unemployment rate dropping?
Yes, it is a healthier economy. It is still a sick economy, and it's a two-track economy. So you have this incredible prosperity in Seattle. You have cranes all over the skyline. You have a lot of people working, a lot of people doing incredibly well, and then you have a lot of people who are financially ruined from the recession. They don't have jobs or they have bad jobs, and they may never regain their former income levels or their former wealth.
Which I guess brings me to the negotiations over the fiscal slope, step, or cliff, depending on your political orientation or whatever. What are you hearing there that is would bode well for those people in the U6 category that are, that you're seeing not applying for jobs?
The fiscal choice, let's call it, which is mostly a political game, because we don't have to have this sudden rise in tax rates and drastic cuts starting in January. This is entirely artificial because of the Congress, because of the Republican House, because of the hostage taking over the debt ceiling. We don't have an immediate debt or deficit crisis. We do have a long-term debt and deficit crisis, and I'm not sure that the negotiations will produce anything that's real, because especially on John Boehner's part, who's not a bad guy, but he has this very radical caucus that he's trying to keep in line. Almost all the revenue is just asterisks, and so are the cuts. Republicans love big spending just as much as Democrats do. President Obama is not negotiating against himself the way he used to do, but he's already started caving on some things, like saying, well, we'll allow the first $400,000 to get low tax rates. This is one of the big misconceptions. People making more than $250,000 will only see their tax rates go up a little bit on the income over $250,000. They'll still get low tax rates, 50-year low tax rates on the first $250K.
Yeah. And that's because we're all getting those low tax rates?
Right.
Well, and we're not talking about raising those tax rates at all.
Well, we're
the lower tax rates.
Right. I mean, we're talking about going back to generally Clinton-era tax rates for the upper incomes. We saw how badly that turned out in the 1990s. The ugly truth is that a lot of middle class taxpayers need to pay a little more. This is politically combustible, and it's also difficult in a time when we've gone through 30 years of stagnant middle class incomes.
When you said President Obama was caving, I mean, is going up to 400,000, he gets a little less money, gets a little less revenue, but is he also caving if he readjusts Social Security inflation formulas?
Sure. I mean, Social Security is not a problem. Medicare is a problem because of our for-profit health care system. But neither of these things need to be fixed immediately, quote-unquote entitlements. And they particularly don't need to be cut back when we're not willing to do serious defense cutbacks. We don't need to be spending more than the next 14 or 17, depending on who's counting, largest militaries in the world combined. And that includes our friends, the Chinese bankers, and our friends, the Russians, whom we can see from Alaska.
Well, as you know, when people talked about how we had to avoid the fiscal cliff because it would put these mandatory cuts on the defense budget, people see it as a jobs program, and that if you, with every congressional district having some defense industry, people didn't want to see any cuts.
Well, this is why Dwight Eisenhower, whom the John Birch Society labeled a communist, the liberator of Europe, five-star general, Republican president, for those of you who are younger than me, called this the military-industrial complex and warned against its undue influence. This is weaponized Keynesianism. If we took some of these trillions of dollars that we're spending on arms and on picking fights around the world and put it into, say, infrastructure, we would have far more productivity, far more jobs than we do just building stuff to blow things up or having this huge global military that we really can't sustain over time.
One more question on the fiscal choice. What do you think is going to happen at this point? John Boehner's now got his Plan B, which I'm unclear on what it is. Perhaps you can explain it to me.
I think he's unclear on what it is because he is negotiating with this very extreme Tea Party House that is very different from the Republican Party of my youth or even Ronald Reagan's Republican Party. And so it is unwilling to compromise. I think at this point a deal will probably be reached. Neither side will be happy. That doesn't mean it will be a good deal, and it doesn't mean that we're going to really address our long-term debt issues, which we need to address. It's not a problem we have immediately. Long-term, we need to address it.
Well, then that takes me back to the question of unemployment and Washington's rate dropping to below 8%, 7.8%. There was infrastructure spending in President Obama's proposal. I don't know if it's going to be there in the end, but do you see something there helping? I still don't see how that helps the 58-year-old who got laid off and has now been out of work for 3 years.
Well, it'll help a little bit. You know, Ronald Reagan added civilian employment in the government during the early 80s, which really helped bring the unemployment rate down. President Obama has been cutting civilian unemployment in the government. And so if you're the 58-year-old who can't get work or the person who is disabled who wants to work but can't get work, historically government jobs have been good jobs for people like that. And we don't have that anymore. And the state levels have been gutted by all these tax limitations. And yet Americans have this huge appetite for it, for government services, that is. And the private sector is not stepping up. And you get into this vicious cycle where people don't have enough money to buy, and so demand is not high. And yet, once again, corporate profits are a record as a percentage of gross domestic product, and yet the companies are not hiring.
John Talton's our guest. He writes about the economy for the Seattle Times. He also writes at his own blog, roguecolumnist.typepad.com. I'm having trouble with words these days, John. You'd think I wouldn't. Holiday shopping is supposed to be the season for retailers. How does it look so far? Do we know anything?
We don't know anything real. Back in the days when I was a business editor, I would always caution reporters that almost nothing that you learn during the holiday season is real. We'll know how it turns out in January and February when we get the real retail sales numbers. The things like credit card use and the anecdotal evidence of people in stores are not to be trusted. We don't know if they're buying. We do know that credit card use has started up again, which is not necessarily good because, quote-unquote, consumers have this huge debt overhang already. But it is true that this season is where most retailers make most of their money. I think we can predict that the ones that are already in a strong financial position and a strong market position, like Amazon and Costco and probably even Nordstrom, will do well to pretty well. The ones that are hurting, such as Best Buy, which is in the backyard being kicked to death by Amazon, is not going to do well. And a lot of small retailers continue to hang on, and by that I mean small locally owned retailers, they continue to hang on by their fingernails. Yeah. I can just count the number downtown that were here 5 years ago when I arrived, these wonderful, distinctive local retailers that are now gone, huge loss for the city.
All right, last quick check-in here. Michigan goes right to work. Ever see Washington State going voting on a right-to-work provision?
I think it's unlikely as long as you have strong unions such as those at Boeing And you also have a progressive ethos here on the west side of the Cascades. Right to work is misleading because what it does is it guts unions and it guts union power. And yes, historically unions have sometimes overreached and sometimes been corrupt. That's nothing compared to, say, Wall Street and the big banks.
But people are pointing to this as a trend for other states.
It absolutely will be in the new Confederacy. When you look at right-to-work states, they have much lower pay than states that don't have right-to-work laws, and they have much less vibrant economies.
Did you just make a new country?
That's what I call it. We have the old Confederacy. And as I remind my friends in Phoenix, Arizona Territory had a delegate to the Confederate Congress through the entire history of the CSA. And then you have the Great Plains states and our friends in Montana and Idaho and up in Alaska, and that is the new Confederacy. And then you have the urbanized blue states that are the new Union.
Yeah. All right. John Talton is economics columnist for the Seattle Times. He's a novelist, and he writes at roguecolumnist.typepad.com. I hope we're talking next week. We'll look at the whole year.
Thanks, Steve.
And as you know, we have been asking some nonprofits what they need for the holidays. Habitat for the Humanity for King County assists low-income families in the community through building, renovating, repairing homes. Kirk Utzinger is CEO for Habitat for Humanity. Kirk, thanks for talking to us.
Steve, thank you for having me.
What do you folks need this time of year?
Well, I can tell you this. There's a lot of folks in this community that need a decent roof over their heads, and we have some very specific call to action that everybody can get involved with, whether your listeners are, you know, at home in the comfort of their homes or out driving on the streets in this what appears to be a winter weather. But we'd like to drive everybody to our website and have them just click on the button called Get Involved.
HabitatsKC.org.
That's correct. HabitatsKC.org. And if you go to Get Involved, your listeners can look at a few options and ways that they can really get engaged. It's very simple. Of course, you know, it's a person's time, their treasure, and their talents. And as far as donations, people can go in. And what we'd like to encourage this year is that everybody that has a home or everyone that has lived in a great home in their life, go on to that website, make a quick online donation in honor of someone they care about.
You guys dedicated 6 homes in October. You have currently in the process of, 11 homes in Rainier Valley, and you could use some volunteers there and other places as well.
You bet. One of the other options is to volunteer, and you can click on that button after you go out to get involved, and it can list those projects that people could get out there and really work close with those homeowners, working on a hand up, not a handout, and learn some skills, volunteer with other people in the community that really care about the King County perspective and homelessness and getting people in homes that really need to be there. And another option is they can advocate. So on that same Get Involved button, they could click on Advocate, and it connects them with their local government officials and issues on housing and how it affects our community. And Habitat would be honored to get any type of support that way through donations, volunteering, or advocate.
All right, Kirk Utzinger, I appreciate you taking the time.
Steve, thank you so much, and a happy holiday to all your listeners. We're big fans here at Habitat. Continue the good work.
Thank you. You too. Kirk Utzinger, CEO, Habitat for Humanity. That website, again, is Habitat SKC, Habitat Seattle King County, HabitatSKC.org. We'll have links up at our webpage. Lots of ways to give this time of year. Andy Hirsch is our engineer. Weekdays produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amin Al-Sadi, Alexandra Garrettin, Daniel Anthony Goodwin, our interns. I'm Steve Scherer. We'll talk tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
Good morning. It's 10:59. Headlines from NPR News, less than 2 minutes away.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Children's, where donors are helping to fund research that may lead to cures for childhood diseases like cystic fibrosis, autism, and cancer. Information at seattlechildrens.org.
Some people think the Mayans were trying to tell us something about December 21st, 2012, and that day is just about here. But really?
The Maya never, ever said anything about the world ending at any time, much less, you know, this year.
I'm David Greene. Go ahead and make plans for the weekend. We'll tell you why in the next morning edition from NPR News.
That story and more tomorrow morning from 5 until 9 o'clock.
Hi, this is Giles Snyder of NPR News. You can count on KUOW and NPR to bring you thought-provoking stories, bright ideas, and new perspectives every day of the year. And we count on you. Your support makes great public radio.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.